This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao, in for Frank Stacio. In his campaign speeches, Donald Trump promised to crack down on undocumented immigrants. And shortly after he took office, memoranda from the Department of Homeland Security seemed to seal the deal. They stepped up hiring for Immigration and Customs Enforcement and expanded the list of offenses that could lead to deportation. For undocumented Latino immigrants, these intentions to crack down on their communities were terrifying. An uptick in arrests, especially of people without criminal records, continue to cause some people to stay off the roads and out of public spaces. Those public spaces include hospitals and clinics. Families in our state are sometimes too afraid to access health care. But some providers are going to great lengths to help them get the care that they need. Dr. Evan Ashkin is a professor of family medicine and the director of the underserved residency track at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Welcome, Evan.
Thanks for being. I'm glad to be here.
Thanks for being here. And Dr. Luke Smith is a psychiatrist and the executive director and medical director of El Futuro, a behavioral health center in Durham, North Carolina. Welcome, Luke.
Thank you.
And also joining us is Elizarina Rojas. She's a community advocate in Orange County. She came to this country from Mexico at the age of 15 and currently has Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival Status, or DACA, which protects her from deportation and provides work authorization. Welcome, Elizarina.
Thank you.
Thank you all for being here. So, Luke, you've been working with various Latino populations in North Carolina for a long time. Can you talk a bit about the environment right now and how you've seen things change in the past 6 months or so?
I think the one word that I would use to describe the environment is one of fear, that we see a lot of people who've come to us over many years, and now their primary impulse is to be fearful of situations. And it's not just fear of, I'd say, the environment out there just in general, but it's also of the people who are trying to provide help. And that's very concerning to me because there are people who do need help and would like to do what they came to this country for, which is to try to help their families, help grow their families, become more strong, really find economic security, and do the things that they came here for. And now the very places that they go where they can get those opportunities, they feel fearful of interacting with. And so that's what I've seen in the environment over the last 6 months, maybe longer, though, because there's been a lot of talk in the air over many years. But it seems like it's escalated over the last bit.
Elizarina, you have DACA, like we said, but you're a community advocate. You work with a number of people who don't. Can you talk a bit about what you've seen, what you've been hearing?
Well, there was definitely a lot of fear going on in the community and also with people like me who have DACA. After the recent elections, I think the percentage of anxiety in the community has increased dramatically, and it's due to the fear to go out and do basic things like driving or accessing healthcare or mental health.
We spoke to a woman yesterday. She's 43 years old. She's undocumented from Mexico. She requested anonymity, but here's what she had to say about her health experience.
Tengo un hijo nacido aquí.
I have a son who was born here. With him, I have some help because he has Medicaid. As far as myself, I go to a clinic, but sometimes I have problems when I need to go to the hospital. I can't go because I'm scared of giving them my information and having that information shared. The truth is, I haven't had an emergency in which I've had to go to a hospital. But I am scared because last year, I went to a hospital in Raleigh to get my normal mammogram, and now I'm scared that with the new president, that information will get out.
That was a woman living without documentation in North Carolina. I'm here with Dr. Luke Smith of El Futuro, Dr. Evan Ashkin of UNC Chapel Hill, and community advocate Elizarina Rojas. So, Dr. Ashkin, you're a family medicine doctor. You work at a clinic that serves a number of undocumented patients. Can you talk a bit about how you are seeing these patients change in terms of their relationship to the access to access the health care that you provide?
Sure. So I work at the Prospect Hill Community Health Center, which is in southern Caswell County. We have probably 60% of our patients are Spanish-speaking, and many of them are undocumented. And sort of like the woman who just spoke, I have had a number of patients who have been reticent to access services that are really vital to their health. I think a poignant example is a young woman who was in her first trimester of pregnancy, had bleeding. Concern is that it was an ectopic pregnancy, which can be a life-threatening condition. I wanted her to go and get an ultrasound so we could know whether the pregnancy was safe or not. And she wound up not going because she was too afraid of both the issue of traveling down to Chapel Hill and then concerns about accessing care, which, you know, really never had been an issue previously. Thank goodness that the pregnancy was okay, but, you know, this was potentially life-threatening.
So we've heard about sort of concerns about access to care, but you've said there are also actual ways in which this stress is manifesting in the physical health of some of your patients.
Absolutely. We see it in both our adults and especially in a lot of the children that we care for. We have seen many children that have refused to go to school. They're afraid when they return from school, their parents may no longer be there. Some of the kids are too young to express that. So what we see it coming out is with headaches, abdominal pain, lethargy. And we see this in adults as well, the same type of depression, anxiety, and a lot of worsening of their symptomatology from their chronic disease.
And are there particular health problems that disproportionately affect the Latino community? And is there any relationship between those conditions and how people are unable to access health care?
You know, there are higher levels among Latinos of diabetes as far as a chronic medical condition than among Caucasians. The need for regular care, obviously, and getting your medications regularly is very important. So we have seen problems with people not accessing the clinic, not filling their medications. And also I'd point out social isolation. I think this was the caller mentioned this. We see many of our patients just not going out because they're afraid to go to any public gathering places where normally they would have social interaction, get community support, but they've been much more isolated, which can also worsen depression and anxiety.
So, Luke, we've been talking about fear, anxiety. How does this manifest in the mental health of individuals that you're seeing?
Boy, there's a lot of ways that comes out. He was talking about the physical ways it comes out, and that's how a lot of people will express that because they feel more comfortable talking about their physical illness more than their mental illness. But then when you get down to it, when you build some trust with the person, they'll start to tell you about their nightmares, their insomnia, their anxiety during the day that makes them not be able to concentrate either in school or at work, more frustrated more easily, and how they parent. So a lot of ways that happens. And then we see people now who will want to engage in a treatment that needs to be long-term, need to walk with the person and help them. And they are telling us at each visit, well, I will maybe see you again. And so that uncertainty has eroded their ability to really fully fling themselves into a treatment that's available for them through our services that already has been difficult for them to engage because it's got stigma around it and difficulty just engaging it in the first place. But now you have this other pressure of, I might not even see you again. And so to have people give you hugs and to say goodbye at each visit really disrupts that treatment process. Additionally, I think another thing that I see is that people are feeling unable to get help when they are victimized or when they are being preyed upon by different things in society. Even when they feel unjustly accused of something, they can't then advocate for themselves with the certainty that they'll be heard or that they'll be listened to and not taken advantage of, even in that situation.
So there's the fear of reporting a health condition in the case that it could cause other ramifications.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Elisa Arena, so you have a friend who decided not to access health care for reasons of fear. Can you tell us her story?
Well, definitely she's afraid to access mental health, and it is sad. It is sad because she really wants to get the access, but at the same time, she's afraid of it. She's afraid that at some point that information can be used against her, like in a immigration court. So, which I am not sure if that's possible or not, but definitely there is help and there is hope for this mom, but she's too afraid to go and get some therapy.
So there's a lot of fear and uncertainty about how your information will be used, what may happen when you're en route to a clinic. There have been reports that, you know, ICE has more freedom now to choose who they detain, concerns that they could be working in relationship with local police. Have you all had any interactions with police or law enforcement, and how would you characterize those interactions?
It's a good question. I think that we hear the effects of policing in the community and how it's negatively impacting people. I'll just reflect on a letter I was writing this morning for a man who has been detained for deportation because he was stopped for fishing without a license. And so his family, who have long-term come to us for help for their daughter, comes to us now saying, our daughter is afraid, she's getting worse, and is there anything you can do for my husband? Because he's now down in whatever other state waiting to be deported because he was in this situation. And so we see it as a negative a lot of times. The other part that we see is the police, when they bring somebody to us and say, hey, can you help this person? They are sensitive to the people that they're taking care of in the community and trying to help protect and serve. But a lot of times we don't see that angle. We do see the people who come to us who are just talking about either what's really happening or the rumors that start. I know that 6 months ago I was getting a lot more of these texts, but of people texting, and all of a sudden my cell phone was blowing up with texts of this may be happening over here, this may be happening over here. And people don't know if those are true rumors or not. And so just that adds to that uncertainty.
How about you, Dr. Ashkin?
Over the past few months, similar experience to Dr. Smith, they are patients who are in like Carver or Chapel Hill in general feel more safe. There's better relationships with police, and sort of the word on the street is that there's fewer problems. However, patients, for instance, in Burlington or Alamance County, show a lot more fear about being in public spaces.
So this fear has changed how the two of you provide care in particular ways, and I want to talk about some examples. But first, I want to hear a quick clip from a woman we interviewed earlier who talks a bit about sort of how this has shaped her life. She is undocumented, living in North Carolina.
Right now, I haven't had a serious emotional change. The issue I have is trying to find the words to explain to my son in case something happens and I have to go. Trying to find the words to explain to him what could happen to me.
So that was a woman living without documentation in North Carolina who asked to remain anonymous. I'm here with Dr. Luke Smith of El Futuro, Dr. Evan Ashkin of UNC Chapel Hill, and community advocate Alisarina Rojas. So you have started giving out emergency plans to families as part of clinic visits. The woman in this piece of tape is referencing that the fear of not knowing if and when she would be deported and how that could impact her family. Tell us about how that factors into your care.
So we've sat down as a group in our clinic and tried to discuss, all right, how do we even bring this up with people? Because it's not like we have a solution. And oftentimes in healthcare, we can put together a plan to address a problem. And so it's difficult when you raise something where you know that people are frightened and you don't have a good answer and a genuine way to help them. Working with El Futuro, Centro Hispano, and other organizations, though, at least we know that we can offer people some reasonable legal advice so they know their rights, and sadly, so they can empower other people to be able to execute important documents for their children with health care and other legal services in the case that they're deported. However, it is heartbreaking to have to give a parent one of these emergency plans. And it's impossible not to put yourself in that same position, what it would be like to go to work in the morning and think that you might never see your children again. So we do address this. We give them the plans, although it feels hollow. And however, it's important for people to know their rights and be able to try to protect themselves as best they can.
Dr. Smith, for people hearing this who may say, yeah, I don't know what my rights are, there is a lot of confusion and uncertainty. What would you say to that?
I think to look at places of security and support for the community, to look at the teachers, to look at the doctors who are there for them, who have been there for them in the past, and to continue to say, look, these are your friends. I think our impulse as healthcare providers is to reach out and to reassure proactively. And so we as a group also need to do a good job of moving a little bit beyond our comfort zone to reassure people when they come in and make an extra effort to go beyond the presenting problem, as we oftentimes say, and say there's a secondary problem in the background that we need to also address, and to just reassure people right now. And so I think I love hearing Dr. Ashkin and his group and the way they do that, us, but others as well, and just to keep that message out there.
How would the two of you individually respond to the critique that, you know, there are lots of Americans that struggle to access a healthcare system that are here legally, so why should we be putting effort and energy toward providing healthcare to individuals who are here undocumented, who have committed a crime?
So at our community health center, we are there to serve our community, regardless of someone's ability to pay, nationality, place of birth. So my response is, we don't have any test of whether we're going to provide care to someone who comes through the door who needs help. And so we certainly care for many Americans who have legal status and many Americans who do not have legal status. So, I mean, my answer is that we are here to serve our community. And if you are here with legal status or without, we will provide services of, we hope, you know, high quality and equal quality to all people that come through the door.
And there's an economic argument at play here, too, that I know both of you have thought about in terms of the burden on the healthcare system when people are not using family clinics and are instead going straight to the ER. Could you talk about that, Dr. Smith?
Yeah, I guess I'll flip that a little bit and say that the burden on our economic system is great when people miss work and people are having difficulty in school and are not achieving educational goals. And so for us to look at the reason why people have come to our country is because they want to get ahead. They want to strengthen their family. And so the more we can put resources into that to help them in that trajectory, that's going to aid our whole community. And so we've seen that people do feel more empowered to work, to speak up, to be part of our community. Alisa Rina is a wonderful example of that and how she's become empowered and now goes and is active in the community in many great ways and is seeking her own education and is employed and has a wonderful family. I think about so many people like that who have taken great steps to move forward. How can I empower that person? That's, to me, a greater argument for economic stability than thinking about the few dollars that we lose to offer that little bit of help to support that person.
Alisa Rina, talk a bit about sort of, do you feel empowered and how, what are your hopes moving forward?
Well, my hopes, I do hope that the amount of anxiety in my community can go down. I hope for driver's license for my community because I believe that could bring the anxiety level a little bit down and that could allow them to drive more safely and with peace of mind and be able to take their kids to school and to go to their appointments at the clinics or at Futuro or any other organization and just to be able to be here without that amount of fear. Because they're here because they dream for a better life. They want to be successful. They left their country for a better life.
Thank you so much to all of you. My guests are Dr. Evan Ashkin, Professor of Family Medicine and the Director of the Underserved Residency Track at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Dr. Luke Smith, a psychiatrist and the Executive Director and Medical Director of El Futuro, a behavioral health center in Durham, North Carolina. And Elisa Rina Rojas, she's a community advocate in Orange County, who's here under DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
This is The State of Things. Just ahead, folk songs with classic rock hearts, the music of Jonathan Bird. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
Sleeping in his teepee, living like a Lakota with his long blonde hair, his long blue yoke.